If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
Actually, at the start of a game, when you hand out those pre-gens or share them online, often there's like a long pause while the players look at them. That's not because they think they're rubbish. That's because people are being polite.
Right.
and they're not wanting. There's probably one of the... Or they might think they're all brilliant and they just can't decide. And often they'll communicate that to you as a GM by saying, I don't care, which sounds quite negative, but it probably means they just want to play.
Welcome to Tabletop Talk, a podcast where I talk to creatives in tabletop gaming about more than what they make. I focus on how and why they create. Do you enjoy discovering the creative process that brings your favorite games to the table? Well, then you're in the right place. Please enjoy this interview with Guy Milner, master of the one-shot and convention play. We talk about how he starts a one-shot knowing the game will only go for a few hours, how he keeps the game moving when there is such a time limit, and what games he thinks lends themselves to good one-shot play. Okay, sit back, relax, plan your next convention game, and enjoy my time with Guy.
This is James D'Amato. When I'm not thinking of new ways to make little guys kiss each other, I listen to Tabletop Talk.
Howdy friends, Craig here. Today I'm chatting with Guy Milner. Guy has played games since he was a teenager and is often seen running games at a UK convention. A few years ago, he started writing about one-shot play at the Burn After Running blog. Now a one-stop shop for resources, advice, game techniques, and play-informed reviews. He's just starting a new project with his collaborator Gaz from The Smart Party, friend of the show, alongside the blog to showcase tight one-shot actual plays on the YouTube channel Unconventional GMs. Guy, this is long overdue. Welcome to the third floor.
It's great to be here. Yeah, good to be on.
So we've got a super interesting subject to get into, Guy. And it's one of the, you know, when you reached out to me and said, hey, Craig, do you want to talk about this? I'm like, oh, my God, yes, I definitely want to talk about this. But before we get into that, we have to go through the standard question that every podcast is going to ask you, which is, at one point, you knew nothing about this hobby. You didn't know that we could grab a sheet of paper, write down a couple numbers, grab some dice and pretend to be somebody else. And then it was put in front of you for the very first time. Can we go back there?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, I always think this question sort of sets you in a geographical and sort of time frame as well, doesn't it?
It does.
And for me, I think the first thing was Fighting Fantasy books were the first thing that I sort of got into. A lot of people, particularly in the UK. So the choose your own adventure, but you had like dice to roll and stuff, little system there. And I think following on from then, I think I must have been about maybe 10 or 11. Wandering around town with some Christmas money and found this strange shop called Games Workshop.
Oh, isn't that something?
And went in. I think it's all the little miniatures and stuff and all of that sort of got, I was like really interested. Oh, this is a bit like those books. And I walked out with a copy of Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, first edition. And was like fascinated. Like I remember reading it on the train back, like this really busy, like, January sales train in the rain. And then I began the sort of process of, I need to find some other people to play this with. And it'd be good if they knew how this worked, because I don't really know what's happening. Like I've generated a character and I've filled in the character sheet at the back. But then I got a bit further and realized I shouldn't have done that. I should have photocopied that first, really, rather than better rub it out and things like that.
You get one character per book.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, buy another one, yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
I began the sort of, I mean, in those days, this is going to make me sound incredibly old, but in those days, you know, there were game magazines and you'd ring a number for a gaming club. So that's what I did. I never had any sort of content in school. I never played games in school. There wasn't any sort of club in the school where I was, but I rang up a number and spoke to a man on his landline, as they sort of all were there then, and said, and he said, oh yeah, come down to Bradford Roleplayers Guild. And so I ended up going there, and I was, I think when I got around to that, I was maybe 13, 14. I was the youngest guy there. Everyone else was sort of, mostly it was people who'd finished university and wanted to carry on gaming. Because obviously there was a university gaming club that they then couldn't go to. So they sort of assembled and we met in a library and did it and played. I don't think we ever played Woofer Up, to be honest. I don't think I got to play that first book for like years and years. And it was, I suppose it's, as with now, it's, you know, people talk about things like edition wars being a thing. And they're enhanced because of the internet, aren't they? But like this was firmly in the sort of days of second edition AD&D. And I was well into that because that was what you could buy in shops. Everybody in this club wanted to play first edition though, because they bought it and they had the adventures for it. So again, I bought all these games that I never played and had to play all these out of print things because that's what all the other people at the club wanted to play. But the grognards, even then.
That's funny. Yeah, that's not new, right?
Yeah.
So I got a couple questions. One, it's always funny to me when I talk to somebody who's, you know, of an older age that grew up in the UK, because especially about Games Workshop, because for us in the US, Games Workshop is strictly a miniatures company. And what we don't realize, because they hadn't really come across the ocean yet, is that they were a gaming company and an integral part of the gaming ecosystem in the UK, and were publishing, you know, books licensing books, and really were the delivery system for a lot of people for role playing. But the question I want to ask you is, you've got a handful or a pocketful of Christmas money. You walk into a Games Workshop. I think it's interesting that you walked out with a role playing game and not a miniature rules game or a box of miniatures. Yeah. Do you remember what happened there? Did you get steered a certain way, or did you steer yourself?
Well, I think some of it was like what Christmas money I had and wanting to get a complete experience from it. And I am from Yorkshire, Craig, so I'm always looking for sort of a bargain, not wanting to spend any money. And I think even then, even like 11-year-old me realized what a sort of money and time sink getting into Warhammer Fantasy Battle would be even then.
Sure.
The advantage that I had, I think, in going in and just buying this random thing, because I must have been with my parents. My dad was big into like model railways. And so he had that thing where he got hobbies, and he got like weird hobbies that you spent a lot of time on and thought about a lot. And you had like weird friends that you only talked about his hobbies with and stuff. So that was quite accepted in my family, really. I think he probably saw this and was like, oh yeah, it's just like that thing that I spend a fortune and hours of my time on. So that's fine. That'll be great. It'll keep me out of trouble. So yeah, I think it was a complete experience kind of thing. And also I have no artistic sort of eye at all, like a tin eye for anything like that. As you can probably tell if you look at the blog and the layout on it. I think even then I was like, I'd have to paint them, and that'd be a disaster. I'd be awful. Like,
so you hook up with this club, you play first edition D&D, even though you already bought a bunch of second edition. When we look at the path, Guy, that you went on, what's the next biggest landmark? So what was the next big game or system that you came across that really kind of you consider a big deal in your progress in the hobby?
Well, I think I played while I was at school. I played with that club, and it's strange for me sometimes to talk with gamers of sort of, I'd say like our generation, really, that with this nostalgia tick, because I look back on a lot of those games that I played then, and most of them were pretty terrible, actually.
Why? What made them terrible?
Quite mediocre. I remember things like, you know, a game of Mega Traveller. Somebody ran where it's literally, we play Saturday afternoons. So one Saturday afternoon was just character creation. Yeah. Next week, come back. We all sat around while someone designed the starship with his calculator. And then went back the next week. I think we got into one fight. Somebody died, like a character, not a player. It would have been a mercy, I think, probably by that point. And a lot of the games were like this. I don't have like these, you know, people talk about fond memories. Yeah. That time we played this sort of classic AD&D module. And it's amazing to go into like the Caves of Chaos. I think even at the time I was like, well, this is fun. And this is like hanging out with people and doing geeky stuff. And I'm into it, and I can get into it outside of it. But even then the games were a little bit like mediocre, even from the sort of standard that I had. I went from there, if you see what I mean. Obviously went to university. I did what I think a lot of people did. I stopped really playing. I became a sort of really, really rubbish collector. Like, I'd stay into the hobby. I'd go into shops. I'd buy, like, books and things. But I very, very rarely played anything. But I always thought. And then I think got in touch. Yeah, when I was living in Manchester, got in touch with another games club and a few things. And then, yeah, there was actually a games club that I'd looked at. I thought, oh, that's not far from me. Looked into it a bit more closely. This is like fast forward to the days of like modern times when there's the internet and things. Like I could actually search it and find it, use Google Maps. And it was literally 10 minutes up the road from me.
Nice.
Went up there and it was this is when I'm sort of in my early 30s. And there was I think it was like Stockport Unorganized Role Players was what it's called. It's run by, if you know, All Rolled Up and de-sanctioned Paul Baldowski was one of the people who ran it. And so got into there and, yeah, started playing with people who I'm still sort of playing with now. From that, went to going to some conventions and getting into, as you imagine, getting into some one-shot play, really, which for a long time was sort of my main thing was running and playing one-shots.
So, Guy, during that period of time when you weren't actively participating in the hobby, but you'd see a shop. I did the same thing, right? Like I would see a game, even though I wasn't gaming, I'd see a gaming shop. I'd go in and I might drop 20, 30 bucks, you know, buy a book that I had nobody to use with, had no like need to do it. What do you think it was that kind of kept you at the periphery that whole time, that this nagging interest that an itch you ended up scratching when you got, you know, connected with the Manchester group? But during that period of time, do you have a sense of why it wouldn't let go of you?
I'm not sure, actually. I think it was that thing of like the potential of it and how much it would be good. And it's interesting to reflect now on sort of how the hobby is and how it's consumed these days. Because like for us, that was what you did if you weren't playing and you were still into the hobby. You basically bought books and read them.
So true.
And occasionally, I think towards the later in, before I was going to Manchester, I was like on forums and stuff and like tentatively trying to find some games and so on. But like if actual plays had been around then, like there's this huge, huge numbers of people who know loads about D&D from watching people play it. And that would have been great. That would keep me ticking along brilliantly. I think I always knew that it was something I'd get back into when I had time, when I had more, you know, when I had the right group to get into. So sort of got tentatively back into it. And then I think probably the next stage, I think this is probably for a lot of us as well, was 2020, really, when it really stepped up because we were in lockdown. So like a lot of people, I ended up playing like 3 or 4 online games a week because there wasn't much else you could do, was there? So really stepped up then and started doing a lot of things online.
Very true. So I'd be curious if you have now really kind of lived two very distinct eras in the hobby, right? So back in first edition, second edition D&D, you were playing. You're playing a lot now. With that perspective, Guy, do you have a sense of what do you think has changed the most and what hasn't changed?
I mean, first of all, I'd say I think we're in like a golden age for TTRPGs. I think that there's the breadth of kinds of games that you can get hold of is incredible. And I also have sort of no time for these people that say, oh, wizards are killing the hobby and doing it like that. They're really, really successful. And that's like it's just a rising tide, if you see what I mean. Like everybody knows what role-playing games are. I'm a teacher and I have kids like come up to me talking about D&D. I started at a new school in September. One of my year 11s came up to me and just said like, sir, do you play D&D? I was like, I do actually a bit. Yeah. And I was like, how did you get, do I just look like someone who plays? He was like, well, yeah, you do. So I was like, what? Really?
You got that stink about you, guy.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, it'll have been there's the beard. I must've had like a black t-shirt with some, I resisted doing the sort of kind of, well, I don't play D&D actually. I play far more interesting games. There's much more options out there for you actually. I think that there's so many options. There's so much out there. There's so many sort of different communities that you can join and nurture. I think we were worried. I was certainly worried over the sort of post-pandemic, whether conventions would sort of get back up and face-to-face conventions would become a thing, or whether we'd stick with sort of online play. But I don't think that's happened. I think face-to-face conventions have sort of grown back to where they were before, alongside a lot of online groups that are really easy. And it feels like now, yeah, if you buy a new game and want to play it, there's quite a few places you can just post a message and get a group together. And if you, I mean, I also have no stick with, you know, these sort of paid GM things.
Yep.
It's absolutely fine. You know, if you want to play something and you haven't got a group and you just want a one shot that you think will be a reasonable quality, you know, by all means, drop the money, get that game, get a plan. That's what it's all about, really, isn't it?
No, I agree. It's funny what you say about the conventions coming back. I think it's really interesting what happened during lockdown and after lockdown. So I think during lockdown, people like myself who never would have thought about playing online did. Yeah. Right. And I went about, like, now I'm running, you know, 3, 4, 5 games on the channel online. Right. I never thought that'd be something I would be interested in. I really enjoy it. I think what I enjoy the most about online play is the reach. I mean, I have tables with people from all over the world, and that's fantastic. It's a diversity of thought and geographical diversity that I cannot have here in Raleigh, North Carolina. Right. But what also is cool, and I wonder if you agree with this, is I felt like it also gave me a brand new appreciation for playing in person. So not being able to do that for several years, then being able to do it again. Now I cherish playing in person. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I get that. I mean, my regular group is online, really. And it actually started sort of by accident. I put something on Twitter. This was like January 2020, so like 2 months before lockdown. It's all Free League's fault, basically. The One Ring second edition was coming out. I realized that I'd got first edition. I'd meant to run it at conventions and stuff. I just hadn't. So I just put something on Twitter saying, anyone want to play One Ring? I'm going to just do some one shots. And got about 12 people from various conventions and game stuff that responded. We set up this Twitter group. I ran the first session. Obviously, it's that thing, the 12 people. Five of us could make the same day at any one time. We played the first session of like the first campaign book for it, Tales from the Wilderland. And after that, we sort of said, oh, yeah, so what's the next one shot we're going to do? And we were all sort of looked at each other like, well, should we just carry on playing through this campaign, like as the five of us? And then had to like post in a Twitter group and say, oh, sorry, guys.
JK. Like,
yeah, we're now a group. After and that group, that's like my regular group. That's still going.
No
like
kidding.
Now. We've gone sort of fortnightly to give a bit more space for recording the channel, but that's still, and we're playing One Ring now. I'm not running it. We're playing second ed One Ring now. We've obviously played loads of games before. It's not one massive campaign.
What are you digging about the new edition of One Ring? I own it and I've read most of it, not all of it. I haven't run it yet. What are you digging about it?
I mean, a lot of it is they've just tidied up things. I think One Ring first edition had that thing where lots of rules were published in supplements. And so I would say it was like pleasantly gnarly. Like there were some things that were more powerful than other things, and it was quite fun to discover it. And the swinginess of combat was quite neat. But they've tidied up a lot of the system, so you don't have some of the strange things that, I mean, I think that there's still things that I quite appreciate that are still like really, really powerful. Like if you've got a Bjorn and get Bjorn's honey cake straight away, absolutely nuts. If you've got a like Ranger, they're absolutely worth the weight in gold. They've kept those little things,
yeah.
But they've just made, you know, combat's a little bit simple, a little bit more streamlined. It's sort of like they've designed all the rules at once rather than a chapter by chapter subsystem stuff. And obviously there's been lots of iterations of it. I'm really pleased they didn't change it that much, to be honest, as well, because it was a really good system for emulating what it set out to do.
When in the game that you're running with this group, or ran with this group, and this is the part where I, you know, so for me, Guy, when I buy a system, I've got to read it, I've got to let it sit for a while, I got to go back, I've got this weird process I go through, and the last part of the process before I end up bringing it to the table is I kind of visualize what the game is going to look like being played, right? How am I going to run this game? And where I'm stuck with on One Ring, and this is where this question is coming from, is there's a meta plot in that world, right? There's an overarching from The Hobbit through the three, you know, the three other books. And I'm going to be playing in a small piece of this. How much does that mega plot play into what the game you ran, or are you just carving off a little corner of the world and there's really no attention to that? Does that make sense?
Yeah. I think it's a thing. It's not just a Tolkien thing. I think it's a thing in a lot of game worlds, isn't it? That sort of permissions thing of, oh, but like there might be something, Tolkien might have written something about what happens in this little place in the Misty Marshes or whatever. I generally overcome that by not caring about it. I mean, One Ring does do something quite clever in when it sets. Obviously, I know, as I said, I don't know much about it, but it doesn't. It sets it between The Hobbit and The One Ring, so correct. there's a period of time where not a lot is happening, and it sort of sticks to themes. You know, people have been corrupted by shadow. Yes, yeah, Sauron somewhere. You know, it's all going on, but there is sort of a big area of time and wilderness, I guess, to work through. One of the things that's interesting about particularly first edition is the first campaign, there's a little bit of a who's who aspect to it, where you wander around and meet all the like characters from the books, which can be good, but also one of my players found it really annoying. It's like, why do I have to keep like meeting Radagast?
How many cameos are we gonna have?
Yeah. Can't we meet an NPC? I mean, there was one moment that was really good. Like they go to Bjorn's house and meet Bjorn. It happens in one of the adventures in there. And obviously it's One Ring. You'll know you have like an audience role to make, the sort of social conflict system, and they absolutely screwed it up. So this Bjorn in character like goes over to meet Bjorn and agrees to do this mission for him. Bjorn just thinks they're dicks. Like, he's just like, you guys, what are you doing? And it just this lovely sort of downbeat of like, you'll help him out. Maybe he won't think we're useless then.
Oh, that's great. Oh, that's funny.
But yeah, I mean, I think reading it again, I would maybe do without a lot of the cameos, because I think it's written a bit like that. You meant to go, oh, wow, it's Radagast. That's great. Oh, great. It's King Dane and stuff. And the fact that there's like one or two of them every session just takes it away for a little bit.
And I think I'd be a little bit like your buddy. I think that I would minimize that completely. Maybe you would hear talk of it or something like that. I haven't decided, right? I'm still trying to work it through. Like the starter box for the One Ring, by the way, Free League's, the production value that they do is just incredible. That starter box is amazing. The adventure in it takes place in the Shire, and you actually start off as hobbits. And where I stalled immediately was all the named hobbits that you interact with in that adventure. I'm like, I don't know. I don't think I can use this because I don't want that. Right. What I would rather have is like another Shire somewhere that doesn't have hobbits we know, you know. So I don't know. We'll have to see if I ever get that figured out.
I don't know. Like, spoilers. Wait till like Tom Bombadil shows up. That's like a divisive character in Tolkien's writing if ever there was one. Like, I actually ran the starter set adventures.
And what did you think?
As a one shot, if you see what I mean. I sort of folded the best bits of those five adventures, because they are like training wheels, into a sort of 3.5 hour session. And I did do a sort of like rap battle thing for when they met Tom Bombadil. It was a bit, the players were up for it, so we went there. It's good. I mean, yeah, there's a little bit. It works better. Something like that works better for a one shot, really, than it does for the start of a campaign. Because actually, handing out the characters and somebody's playing, I don't know, I'm going to get the names wrong, like Lobelia Sackville's Bagginses sister or whatever. For a one shot, that's great. You know, someone's playing Balin. That's great. You know who they are. You can do it. You're not going to play them again. You're not going to be worried about what's happening. But yeah, for a campaign, it's that thing of like, right, it's all about us. But wait a minute, everyone around here is related to something in this book. It takes it away from making the heroes the stars of the show.
And it takes away from it being our world too, right? As part of that process. So I completely agree. Guys, the Insider Insight series allows me to sit down with designers, developers, artists, writers, and creators and learn how they approach their work. I try to understand their process, inspiration, and the methods for crafting their creations. We've got a lot to talk about with Guy. We're going to focus on really two things that I don't think gets talked about enough. And it's why we brought Guy on. We're going to talk about running a one shot. We'll also talk about convention play. We'll be right back.
Hey, everyone. This is Zoe, co-host of the Miniculum podcast, here to tell you about our new Kickstarter project launching June 1st of this year. The Marginal Worlds Kickstarter is a deck of 50 easy-to-play magic items pulled directly from medieval manuscripts that you can play in any TTRPG. So if you're looking to dazzle your players with magic items once hidden for centuries in ancient tomes, sign up on Kickstarter or themaniculumpodcast.com to check out sample cards, playtest them yourself, and bring the magic to your table on June 1st.
I think before we start talking, Guy, we've got to talk definitions, because I have learned that the term one shot means different things to different people. So on my channel, I quote unquote run one shots all the time. Like recently I did a quote unquote one shot of Court of Blades by Sean and Navi Drake. And it took 7 sessions. Right. So that was our one shot. So for me, a one shot is a beginning and an end. Right. We're not going to play this and just see where it goes for forever. We're going to say we're going to play this long for this amount. We're going to get through this piece. To me, that's a one shot. For other people, they're like, a one shot is literally we're going to sit down and we're not going to get up until we're done. Where do you fall on that? Do you think it doesn't matter?
I think I tend to be sort of the latter one. I think a one shot is one session of play.
Yeah.
And you might have it. So you might have, the exception is you might have at a convention where you've got sort of slots. You might run a game that's deliberately over 2 slots. Mm-hmm. And there are some games that sometimes you sort of need that to breathe. But that would be sort of 6-7 hours of play with a significant break in the middle. But yeah, I tend to think a one shot is a one and done. Obviously, you'll have breaks. You will stand up in the middle of it. You go to the bathroom and stuff. But yeah, it's I would say that's a one shot of one thing. And I tend to be, I've got in my controversial opinion about campaigns is that a campaign, the ideal length for a campaign is like between 4 and 12 sessions. And if it's going to run longer than that, you should split it into seasons and do that. Have a rest, play something else, then come back to it and have another season or leave it, you know, just leave it hanging with where it is. So 7 sessions, I'd be like, that's a medium length campaign for me.
I think that's important. It's funny you say that because we've been running Forbidden Lands for almost 3 years now on the channel. And that's what I've done is I've broken it into seasons. So finished. And it's not like pre-programmed seasons. Like what has happened is I'm like, we're at a bit of a transition point. We've been playing for like 10 sessions now. Let's take a break. Right. Let's leave the game for a couple months and let's get hungry for it again. Because what I don't want, I want them to play through this entire Raven's Purge. But what I don't want to happen is for it to turn into a slog. And as much fun as we're having, as great as the system is, as much as I love Raven's Purge as a campaign book, man, you can get tired of it. And you can get kind of like slogged down. And I learned that by taking that 3 or 4 month break, you come back ready. Like you start getting like the month before it starts, you start getting hungry again. Yeah. Like I really miss it. So I completely agree. So now that we understand what you mean by running a one shot, I would venture to guess that a lot of people listening have never done that. I think it's a term we use a lot, but it's very, very rare. So can we kind of frame that up from a GM's perspective? So I say, hey guy, I need you to run a one shot on my channel. It's going to be 3 hours long. You pick the system, you know, you do. What's the first thing? What are some decision points you now need to make now that you know you're going to be running a 3 hour one shot? What process do you go through?
Okay, so slightly system dependent, but for like 99% of systems, you're going to get pre-generated characters. There's a handful of games where it might be quick enough to do at the table. But even with that, even with quite quick character generation, I tend to prefer to do that work for it because character generation is sort of, you're almost playing a different game to playing your character, if you see what I mean. So I don't want to do 2 separate things. I want to have that. So I want some pre-gens there. I want to think about the plot. One of the things I'd say with one shots about how you structure the plot of one shots is to keep it nice and simple. Yep. Like you don't need to overcomplicate it. It's not going to be a masterpiece. A little 5-room dungeon would be really good. You know, the John 4 idea. I think, I mean, there's an episode of this cast actually, isn't it? People could go and listen to that now and work out what a 5-room dungeon is.
I love you guys.
There's also a blog post in Bird After Running. So you check, read that as well, you know, do both things. It could be something like that. And then think about how you're going to be able to accelerate the pace a little bit and get a satisfying arc in that 3-hour session. On the grounds that within a 3-hour session, you're probably going to want to take 1 or 2 breaks as well. And you're going to have to, if you're running a one shot, one thing that you should expect to probably have to do, unless you're running a one shot in the same system that your group normally plays as a break, is you're also going to have to teach the system to the players. And I think, I mean, that in convention play, that's a real thing, but I think it's, it's a technique when you run one shots that's often neglected, that actually it's not just the games mastering bit of it, of actually being the GM and reffing it. It's that you're going to have to introduce the players to the system and talk them through what decisions they can make.
So let's break this down into smaller pieces real quick. One, I want to talk about the pre-gens, right? So if you know you are going to run a one shot for four players, are you bringing four pre-gens? Are you bringing eight pre-gens? Like, how do you handle that?
I don't think there's an easy system to it. I mean, it sort of, I'll be honest, it varies if I'm making them on how long it takes me to make one pre-gen, to be honest, is the main determiner of it. And also if I've run that system before, I don't think that you need to give like hundreds more pre-gens. I don't think you need eight for four players, if you see what I mean. Yeah. You might want to be safe for five players. And that also gives you, if you're running at a convention, that means you might be able to take an extra player if you need to. But I don't think you need to think, oh, I'll get loads and then somebody will want them. Because actually, at the start of a game, when you hand out those pre-gens or share them online, often there's like a long pause while the players look at them. That's not because they think they're rubbish. That's because people are being polite.
Right.
and they're not wanting, there's probably one of the, or they might think they're all brilliant and they just can't decide. And often they'll communicate that to you as a GM by saying, I don't care, which sounds quite negative, but it probably means they just want to play.
Yeah.
I don't think you need loads and loads of pre-gens. I tend to go for, fairly straightforward archetypes. I often think of, you know, fighter, wizard, thief, cleric, analog, even if we're playing in like a science fiction system, that right. sort of analog will work. I try and get, if you're playing in a established setting, it's good to get a mixture of some of the stuff that people might want to see in that setting. So like if I'm playing 13th Age Glorantha, if I had four players, I might bring six pre-gens where one of them's a duck and one of them's a troll. If right. I'm running a Star Wars game, I'd make sure there's a Wookiee in there. I'd make yep. sure there's a droid in there because that it feels Star Wars, doesn't it, from there? D&D, I just do like a smattering of classes and see what's there for it. And just, you don't need loads and loads of options. Just make the ones that are there good. I mean, you're already... Often that can take longer than actually preparing the rest of the session doing them. So don't overthink it and don't make more than you need to do.
So Guy, you're at that moment where you've put the pre-gens in front of the players and we have that pause. And as you're saying that, I've been in that moment so many times. Yeah. What do you do to help? Like, do you say, hey, Billy, do you want to play this? Or can someone give me an idea? Do you give an overarching like synopsis on each one? Like, how do we get characters picked?
So I would do a very brief, this is a fighter, he's big, he's got an axe, he's going to smash things in the middle of the table. This is a wizard, you're going to have to use the magic system, explain whether that's difficult or hard. Sometimes there are a few games where you need to give a little bit of indication. So I run a lot of 13th Age at conventions and as one-shots, and 13th Age has a lot of player-facing mechanics. So playing a barbarian in 13th Age or a ranger is really straightforward, really for the player. Well, not really straightforward, but fairly straightforward.
Right.
You haven't got a lot of mechanics to deal with. Playing a fighter is actually quite challenging. You've got to actually interpret your roles and choose which powers you're doing each time. So making that explicit, so that players can also choose based on whether they know the system or not and what their background is. With that long pause, I mean, literally it's, right, don't be shy. And sometimes I'll get to the point of like, you are going to have to pick, like, stop being polite. And the sort of the final option is collecting them in and saying, right, I'll hand them out to you and you can swap if you want to.
But we got to get started.
Them into habit. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Otherwise, we're never going to get started here from there. But yeah, it is. I think if GMs are running one shots for the first time, that reaction to putting the pre-gens out, as we've said, is really common and it's not a reflection on what they are. It's just people being polite and not wanting to pick first.
I think your description to get to the second piece of, you know, keeping it simple, the five room dungeon, you know, John's idea of the five room dungeon, a simple one MacGuffin, like yeah. clear the rats out of the sewer type thing, right? That's going to take a one shot. If I know I'm going to have six or seven sessions with a group, I'm going to start things a certain way. If I know I've only got 3 hours with a group, I can't start things that way. So, obviously, it varies by the system. It varies by the game that you're playing. But as a general rule, How do you like to start the session?
So there's a few techniques that I sort of rely on a lot. And this is, I generally run quite sort of pulpy action oriented one shots. And most of it is at conventions, but obviously some of it is for the channel or just as breaks with other people. And I have quite a, so I get players to introduce their characters. The way I generally do this is as a montage and do it like a sort of 80s or 90s TV series. So if you think this is going to be, this is aging our audience again, isn't it? With more nostalgia. But if you think about like Robin of Sherwood or Quantum Leap, all those shows used to begin over the theme music with a sort of series of action scenes from the rest of the series or the season. Because obviously they had that footage anyway and put it together. So I say, right, okay, I want you to introduce your character, but what you're going to do is you're going to describe them doing something awesome in their last adventure. So before you got here,
that's a cool idea.
Just describe them doing it. And so in some games, depending on how sort of gonzo I want to go, I'll even say, if you want to, you can say who's playing a character, like which actor is playing a character, because that gives a really good hook to it. The danger with that is that then people go off talking about their favorite Schwarzenegger films or whatever. So, but doing that and what's really clever about it, not from my idea, but what players are really clever at doing is that very often the one player will start. I mean, as you judge the table, pick the player you think will give the best start to do it first. The next player will follow on from that. And although they can be, you're imagining these could just be discrete scenes. You end up with one little montage of this massive fight from their previous adventure.
Oh, that's cool.
They're all kind of joining together. And while the barbarian stood on top of the sort of pile of skeletons, hoofing zombies, there's also the mage in the background fireballing some of them. And you get that. Once you've got that, you're sort of there. The players have done a bit of role playing. They've been their character. Everyone's got a cool idea about what they are. And it stops that introduce your character bit, which I think is important to do, but in a one shot, you get people where they're like looking at the character and say, "Well, I'm an elf. I've got a two-handed sword. I'm very good at climbing walls. Very good. Yeah, I'm like 80% good, and all that nonsense." Where you want to be like, "Don't look at the sheet. Just say what you do." So it's awesome. So I would do that. That's the first kind of step. Following that, I tend to do a mission briefing that's literally just a monologue from me. So what they're doing, I kind of have set. And then go very quickly into an action scene that, depending on the system, it might just be a sort of series of skill rolls to get them into it. It might be a fight, actually. It might be a fight. And sometimes even it'll be introduce yourselves, set the scene, you're wandering through a forest, something happens, there's a fight, they have to battle some goblins or whatever. And from that, then the mission emerges. So they have this little sort of training fight because you sort of need to have a nice, easy fight at the start because something went into the system. You don't want to kill anyone in the first fight. Otherwise, they're going to have 2.5 hours of sitting around watching everyone play. And then from that, they've got the mission on. And if you can get that first sort of half hour really pacey and nailed with that, it makes the rest of it really smooth and it starts to sort of run itself because the players will start to interact from that.
There's a lot of stuff in here that I love, guys, stuff that I had not really even thought about. First off, the you tell me what you did the last adventure. I don't know where you got that from, but that's freaking genius. And it's genius on so many levels. One, it helps push the player into the skin of the character. Like you're forcing this, right? You're not asking them to read the character sheet. You're forcing them into their character, which I love. Two, as a GM, you are getting so much kindling from that story. Like the players are telling you, this is what I love. This is what I want to do. This is how I want to engage this game. Like by how they frame that scene, you now are completely informed at what type of table you're dealing with, which God, I love that as well. And it also helps us understand, because it's an important thing and it's something that I do on the channel, because a lot of the times when I'm running a game on the channel, my players have never played the system. So I've got to teach as we play. And even if my players have played the system, I still do that because there's people watching it. Like one of the reasons people watch actual plays is to learn the mechanics.
Definitely, yeah.
And I want to expose that on there. So I love all of that. Now, the next thing I want to talk about, though, is kind of the pacing. Right? Because you're on a clock. So I'm curious, do you have like, I need to be here at in the first hour. I need to be here by the second hour, and I need to be here when we have 30 minutes left. Do you have that figured out?
Not in as much detail. I don't tend to. What I have is sort of there's a hard deadline I often have, because often in sort of action-y one shots, you're going to end with a big scene that's probably going to be a fight, isn't it? With lots going on. And I have in the back of my mind that, okay, the slot finishes at 4 p.m. So like 3 p.m. or 3:15 p.m. or 3:30 p.m., we need to be starting that fight.
Right.
I don't have beats mapped out for the rest of the session, but what I will sometimes do, and it depends on the system that I'm running, that I'm playing. So like 13th Age, I've run loads of one-shots. I've sort of got the pacing and the balance right. I don't really need to think about it. If I'm running something that I'm less familiar with, what I'll do is I'll have some sort of collapsible bits in the middle. So you have some scenes that you could incorporate or not incorporate. So the trip through the, so I ran Torg Eternity, sort of second time I've ever run it at a convention, last weekend. And it's the cyber papacy. They've got to go through the Paris catacombs to try and stop this ritual going off. The Paris catacombs had two options for me. I could run that as a really quick montage where they just made a few skill rolls and went through it, or the middle ground is they could have done it as a sort of narrative 13th Age style montage where they do obstacles and go around. Or the final one, I had a little sketched out sort of six room dungeon for them. And actually the players, I had four players. I'd said I could run for five, but I only had four players, and they were quite on it and had driven through the first scene. So we went for the dungeon then, because I was like, I've actually got time to do this. So having a little bit, it sounds like a sort of advanced technique when you're prepping, but even just having some collapsible bits in the middle that you could run one way or you could run another way, and having some optional bits, which are cool if you can get them in, but you don't have to be too attached to them. That will really help to give you that flexibility so you can eyeball it and do it. And the other thing to remember with a one shot as well, like even if it's at a convention, if you're running it and the play goes in a different direction, you're not quite sure, just take a break. And be completely honest with it. So, okay, right, we're just going to take 5 minutes there. I have to be like, I'm often like really explicit, and I'll say like, you've gone in a different direction to me, so we're just going to take 5 minutes there. If it's okay, I'm going to have to actually like just do a little bit of prep here. So like, just don't talk to me for 5 minutes, because you'll have that thing where they're like, oh, it's cool, where'd you get the idea for that? I'm trying to lay some train tracks that you can actually ride on later on from where you've taken me. I need to work out what's in this swamp because you've done, and actually take a break and change it there. You always have that thing. You're not sort of locked in there having to run with that.
So Guy, when you buy a new game or you come across a new game, how do you evaluate whether you think it's going to be good for a one shot or not? So what are things in a game or a system that you think lends itself to being good for a one shot?
So first of all, I generally think you can run anything as a one shot. And it just that some games need a little bit more finessing, and you might need to change the structure of them quite significantly to make them work as that. I think games that work well as a one shot, you want rules that are understandable enough to teach quickly. Mm-hmm. The setting is often important.
Can you give me an example of that? Like, let's use 13 Age. Like, why 13 Age has worked so well for you as a one shot? What is in there that's just easy to grok?
Well, so 13th Age is quite a complex system, as you know.
Right, that's what I was thinking. So
actually, how it plays, that doesn't work. However, all of the vocabulary of 13th Age and all of the things, I often say when they get the print, if you've not played it before, everything on this character sheet that you recognize from a D&D character sheet of any edition means the same. And you're going to be rolling a D20 and adding a bonus and trying to hit somebody's armor class. All of that is the same. 13th Age also, in its purest form, comes with a really easy to understand setting. The Dragon Empire is a brilliant setting. It's got loads of stuff going on, but it is a bit kitchen sink fantasy. If you've played D&D, you've got your head around what it is. You know, there are elves, there are dwarves, there are dragons. It's all of that. And there are little cool things added on that you'll encounter, but generally the setting isn't something that you have to explore differently. Now, I know where you might go now is say, well, I've also run quite a lot of 13th Age Glorantha, which has got a really complicated setting as well. I sort of modify that by, again, not really caring about canon with Glorantha and just being where it's set. You know, your tribesmen, there's chaos everywhere. The Lunars are bad. We're not going to talk about basket weaving or what a particular tattoo your Orlanthe has. Generally, when I run 30 Days Go Ranter at cons, there'll be at least two players who are really into that and want to do that. And like, it's fine, talk amongst yourselves. And the rest of us, we're just going to like smite chaos and stove heads in with axes and be big heroes from that. I think in terms of systems that are easy to understand, it often helps to have like reference points help like that. So while PBTA games require a slightly different, Powered by the Apocalypse games require a slightly different approach, they do have that big advantage of the core mechanic is the same in all of them. And it's really straightforward. And also, they also have this thing about, you know, if you want to just describe what your character does, and I'll interpret it as a move, and you do it, actually playing them is straightforward. They require a different approach and a different headspace as a GM to run them, or MC to run them. But to play, just crack on. And if you've played Apocalypse World or Dungeon World, you sort of know what's going on with Brindlewood Bay, or, you know, the core mechanic is the same and the style of play is common across them, if that makes sense.
It does. No, it makes a ton of sense. For someone listening right now, that I think we've probably have piqued some interest, right? So we've got some people that have either have never run a one shot or want to return back to it. Can we give them maybe two or three systems that you have come across that you would say, hey, if you want to find something new to run a one shot in, here's what I would explore. Is there some systems or settings out there that you think people should look into?
So my first advice, if someone's not run a one shot before and you're wanting to run it, and you definitely should, the system that you should run is the system that you already know. Is the main thing. Like if you're a D&D player and you've got a D&D campaign and you want to run a one shot as a little palate cleanser or a break, because some of your groups run a D&D one shot, like go for that. Don't like having to buy a new book, which I'm sure like both of us do, like buy a new book and then prepare it and then write up your little one sheet of rules cheats. It's more work than you need to do. Like don't try and do that. Pick a system that you already know and a setting that you already know, and go with it with that. So, I mean, D&D, I don't think is actually brilliant for one shots because of the sort of resource management mechanic of it. In a D&D game, you're never more powerful than you are like before, as you set off from the town, because right, you've got all your stuff. By the time you're fighting the dragon at the end, you've like used all your spells and you're on the half hit points and you're really struggling. So I don't think D&D as a one-shot experience is always that great. But if D&D is what you want to run, then go with it, because if you know the system, it will work really well. And if you're wanting to pick a system sort of bespoke and run it, I find that the Aegon games or Agon games, the Paragon system work really, really well for that. It's a more narrative style, but they come with a quite straightforward system. I mean, there's a lot of actual plays you can watch to get an idea of it. There's several on Unconventional Gems, by the way. I'm sure you've got some as well, Craig. So watch some of those to get an idea of how it runs. Aegon comes with, it's Greek heroes in Greek myths. So it's a really Easter Grok setting. It's a really straightforward narrative system. And there are lots of usable one-shot. There's lots of islands prepared for it that you can pick. And they are collapsible. They will fit into a one-shot structure. It's got an episodic structure built into it. A lot of the heavy lifting that you might need to do to structure your adventure is already done there.
Yeah, and what's also great about Aegon 2 that I love is that it's a wonderful game to pull out of the off the shelf to show somebody what's possible, because it's a very different RPG in a very good way. So I have used Aegon as an example of saying, hey, if you really want to like blow somebody's mind that's only played D&D, run an island in Aegon and watch their faces as they realize what is possible in this hobby.
Yeah, yeah.
So let's bleed now over to where we often see one shots and where you're very active, Guy, which is convention play. I will tell you that I have never played at a convention. Now, I've run two or three convention games before. And I learned as I went. It was trial by fire, because I had never run a 3-hour game before. I've always run, you know, multiple episodic, multiple sessions. I think I want to start with a bit of a sales pitch, which is, if there are people that have conventions on their calendar, they haven't signed up for games, why do it? Like, what is great about playing at a convention in your mind, or running at a convention?
So this is a hobby where actually the peak of the hobby is playing games. Yeah. And it gives you a chance to play games with different people in different settings. And I really strongly believe that is what the hobby is about. It's not about collecting books and reading them.
That's
and
imagine, a
like we all did for us, yes. You know, that, I mean, we all do that as well. Yep. And it's certainly not about like going on Twitter and arguing about like the hobby. It's all about play. And you will get to encounter new games, new approaches, new techniques all the time from it. I mean, I think, you know, if people are worried about that first step, obviously one of the things with conventions is you've got to get there. You've probably got to book a hotel room. You've got to, I mean, the actual cost of going to the convention, pretty much, I don't know if it's the same in the States, is minimal, isn't it, compared to transport and accommodation while you're there.
Yeah.
If you've not been to one before, the place to start, I would say, is like there's lots of online cons you can go in, and that cost is zero there. And just see what it's like playing with some fresh faces and new people. Some of my absolute sort of, you know, best gaming experiences have been at conventions, and sometimes for games that I was a little bit, you know, unsure about. I wasn't sure if it was what I'd be into. It wasn't my first choice as a sign up.
What's a game that surprised you?
A game that surprised me. I think Dungeon Crawl Classics was the one that really surprised me. The
oh, first so? Time That's I played interesting. That,
and I've become a bit of a I have quite a strong opinion on Dungeon Crawl Classics, that it looks like this OSR D&D clone, doesn't it? And it very much looks like, oh, this is, which is not the kind of play that I want to do, but it doesn't play like that at all. And the idea of, you know, you're playing four characters and most of them will die in a zero level funnel. I was like, I don't know. I mean, it'll probably be fun though. It was an evening game, I think. And so it's like, well, you know, the bar's open. I don't want something I need to think about too much. We'll just go with that. I had an absolute blast. And if anyone's listening and hasn't played a DCC funnel, I'm assuming you've run it or played one, Craig.
I've not done it on the channel. I've run it for my locals, and it surprised us too. I think that there was a lot of people who are like, okay, Craig, we'll try this. And I'm like, I could smell something special in the funnel, and it was a huge hit.
And you get like, what I was surprised, how much you end up caring about your turnip farmer with a pig and a stick because you're like, but he's got, and some of it is you're like, but he's got a wisdom of 14. He'll make a really good cleric. Like, you start with these four players and you get really attached to them. I have to, when I run it as a one shot, I have to say, like, just don't, like, you are gonna, you will get attached to them. Just don't do that straight away because like the first combat, you're going to realize how this works and why we've got 24 player characters on the table here, because we won't have 24 after that one. It manages to do something quite, I don't know, I was going to say transcendental. That sounds a bit pretentious, doesn't it? But it's a very different experience, isn't it?
It is.
You have that kind of, and I've, that's a game where I've only ever run it as a one shot, and I've not managed to get that thing where you play through a funnel and then the characters that are left write their first level now. They go on a proper adventure. But imagine how good that'll be. I'm sure lots of listeners have done that, but it must be great.
And it is good, but it's very important. And we found this out the hard way playing it in person. It's a totally different game. When you get to level one play, it is not the funnel anymore. And you have to really shift gears. Yeah. And you really, and this is part of what's great about DCC, is every class is its own system. There's a little bit of system mastery that the players need to pick up because the GM can't carry it all. And we weren't ready for that. I want to go back and revisit it because I don't feel like we enjoyed level one as much as we could have, because I didn't realize what a transition it was going to be.
So for
convention play. So now we've got somebody going, okay, you know, I listened to Guy and Craig talk about this. Maybe I will sign up, and they do. What are some reasonable expectations they should have coming into that game? So if they're going to sit down for their first convention game, what are some expectations that we can set for them so that they are not thinking something's going to happen? They're not disappointed. What should they look forward to?
So sort of best practice, I guess this is, because I think there are still sometimes conventions where you can have disappointing play experiences. But the vast majority of them are really positive, and it's got a lot better in the last kind of 10 years from there. But you expect to be given pre-gens. I think that's standard. If character generation is done at the table, it'd be something really quick. Like Aegon is one of the games where you might actually do it at the table because you're literally picking a few things and doing it. You can expect that. You can expect I think you should be able to expect the game will run to the slot and be within the slot. I often say it's better for us. It's better for a game to finish like an hour early than half an hour late, because there'll be another slot afterwards, and there'll be other, you know, everyone's busy and stuff. I think you should expect safety tools. I think conventions, most of them do. I think conventions should actually mandate doing a sort of open table X card. So expect that to be shared at the start. Obviously, in your own game, they're often not necessarily, you won't always need them if they're people that you play with all the time. I do actually tend to use them with people that I play all the time, because people's experiences change, and you don't know what people are into depending on what the game or what they might be sensitive about at that moment. But expect that's nothing weird if someone's explaining an X card or lines and veils. I think also a bit of advice I'd give for convention players is expect to have one or two breaks in the slot. There's no other situation where you'd be expected to sign up and stay sat down for 4 hours.
Yeah.
I've had things where people are like kind of very gingerly. Can I go to the bathroom? And it's like, I've forgotten. And be prepared to ask, you know, if you're a GM, not to go to the bathroom, but be prepared to say, oh, should we have a break? We've been playing for an hour and a half. You know, be prepared to do that, because also the GM, it's the hardest thing for him to realize that, because if you're running a game, you're on the spot all the time. You don't notice that it's been an hour and a half often. So, you know, be prepared to call that, be prepared to do that. I think the flip side of that, sort of how to give you all in a convention play, is, you know, things like find out in advance where the game's being run so you can show up on time. You know, bring a pencil, bring some energy, engage, all the sort of good practice player things as well. If you don't understand something, ask at the start. You know, don't turtle. If you're playing a one shot, don't be scared. Yourself in the room. Yeah, lean into it. And if you can, like, think about what action you're going to take before it's your turn, that in any game that helps. And yeah, sort of play up, you know, be prepared to bring the other players in and listen and engage with that. I mean, all that is common sense, you know, just show up and enjoy it. But when players do that, it really, really helps. And it's not just about the GM in any game, is it? It's about the table. The GM is a player too. It's about the fun that you bring from there.
So the last thing I want to talk about here, Guy, is goals. And I want to talk about specifically goals for the GM. So if you're a GM running a convention game, what are some goals that you should set for yourself? Things that you think, okay, at the end of this game, if the players tell me this, I know I've succeeded. What headspace can we put GMs in?
I think, so I might change that a little bit and say that actually it's one of those things where it will make you a better GM. Running for new players will make you a better GM. And because you're out of your comfort zone a little bit, and you're having to respond to different techniques, you're having to respond to different expectations, and you're having to set it up and do it there, and it makes play with your home group just really fly, because you'll pick up techniques, you'll pick up things. Again, you'll have that experience from it. I would say GMs shouldn't need to be too harsh on themselves. I wouldn't want anyone to be thinking like, oh, if the players tell me they had a really great time, then it's a success. And because that, the flip side of that, if they don't, then it won't be, and they might just be tired at the end of it and do it. I really like to try and remember to actually ask for feedback at the end, ask for stars and wishes, you know, ask for what people liked about it and what people, I don't frame it as negative, because you don't really want to receive negative feedback after you've had sort of 4 hours
game. People don't enjoy giving it either.
No, yeah, scenarios. It's not a pleasant, let's not end it on a downer with that. But that kind of thing, if you played that scenario again, or if I ran that scenario again, what would you like to see more of? Like, what would you like to shift? Or the sequel to that adventure, what would you put in? What didn't we see enough of? One of my other one-shot techniques that I talk about quite a bit is you sometimes have to encourage player-player interaction, if you see what I'm not player-player, PC-PC interaction. So you really want to get a situation where your player characters will actually talk to each other while they're doing the stuff in character. And one technique to bring that is to get an NPC that is sort of a catalyst for that. They can be a bit of a comic, sort of comic foil for them. When I run Glorantha games, it's often a duck that comes along with them. It can also be obviously gnome, halfling, whatever. I'm being a bit speciesist now, aren't I? But you get the idea. That can just sort of prod them a little bit and get them to interact. And then you've got a triangle to do it. And that sort of player interaction can really, really help. And then that's something that I look for when I'm running con games.
I want to dig into that a little bit if we could, Guy, because I think that's really interesting. Can we kind of set the scene a little bit? Because I think that's very interesting, not even just for a one shot, but for GMs in general. Like, give me a sense of what this NPC is, and can you set the scene of how we could use that NPC to push them to play in character as character?
So I think it's more of an issue with a one shot because you have players who don't know, but they don't know each other
right
either. And so while some players will be quite confident at pretending to be Thorgar the Barbarian or whatever, some players will be the listener who's gone to that convention for the first time may be quite rightly a bit shy about doing that in a way they wouldn't be in their home group. And so if you introduce an NPC sort of companion who's going to be there or is going to be around and about the group as they go around, they can ask questions of what's going on so that they can specifically ask in character, like, so, oh, no, the dragon's already been here. What are we going to do then, Thorgar? And then, you know, if you ask a player a question in character, the natural thing to do is to mirror that and respond in character. And then another player will join in and you sort of set that up. And I think you do sometimes have to plan to encourage that in a one shot because it might not happen naturally. And often if I've run one shots and that hasn't happened, that's sometimes where it feels a little bit flat because we've played the game, we've rolled dice, but we've not done the sort of amateur dramatics. We've not had that bit of fun in it.
And those are the moments that we tend to remember, right? That stick with us, not rolling the 20. It's that you remember that time when we met the so-and-so barkeep and this happened. Yeah. Those tend to be it. Now, I said that was going to be the last thing and now I've got another question for you. So I lied. I would imagine for some listeners, and I had this fear as well. I've since gotten rid of it after running so many games for so many quote unquote strangers in the last several years, but there's this nightmare that you are going to run a convention game, four strangers sit down, and I don't know how to put it other than to say one of them's a dick, right? You have this fear that you're going to have a sour apple show up. First of all, how often have you encountered that? Is that a reasonable thing? Like, are people just like you're like, hey, it might happen. It barely, like, I'm trying to get a sense because I know that that could stop a lot of people from saying I'm going to run a game.
I'd say people like actually being a dick has happened to me. I don't think it's happened to a game that I've run at all.
Why do you think that is?
I'd say I've had sort of suboptimal behavior.
Okay.
And this is, all with a caveat. You don't know what people have got going on or what. So I've had situations where like some players, we call a break for 5 minutes. Some players go off, like go for the break and came back 40 minutes later. And we're then quite put out that we'd like started playing again. And we're like, well, but there was a big queue for ice creams. And I literally was like, well, that'd be okay if you'd brought us all back ice creams. But like we said, it was 5 minutes. Like,
yeah,
we're all playing.
Like, yeah. Yeah.
I've had a couple of things. And again, you don't know what people have going on where players can be a little bit disengaged or actually fall asleep at the table. You know, a long convention, you know, Sunday afternoon, particularly if there's been some socializing in the game as well. I think it's also about not being too polite and actually saying like, let's take a break. Like, are you okay? Do you want to stay in the game? Do you need to take a break? Like, give them that opt out. I always run now with an open table. So it's just like, if you're not having fun, then you don't have to stay. Like, nobody's forcing you. If you're not having fun, you don't have to stay. I always say as well, like, that applies to me too. Obviously that'll have an impact on all of you. And I'll let you know if I do it. But, you know, if we're not having fun, we won't do it. I've never actually done that and walked off with it. But I think in the back of my mind, having that, it could happen. Yeah.
Yeah. And by putting it out there, you take some pressure off, I think, which is great. You kind of release that valve a little bit, which I think is cool.
Yeah. And I don't think, I mean, in terms of conventions, I think that's fairly rare that you'd get someone who'd go in and actually be a dick. And it's another reason why safety tools are important. You know, if somebody starts bringing something in that's not appropriate, X-carding it and then having that chat about it and then being like, you know, if you really want to bring in this thing, I said at the start, this was going to be like certificate PG or 12 or whatever, you know, that we can't have that in here. That's not how we're going to play. Are you going to deal with that, or do you need to go find another game or sit in the bar for a bit or go and sleep? So I think having that really helps as well. I mean, I would say with that as well, like the GM is naturally the arbiter of that, is the person that will deal with that player. Be absolutely prepared if you're a player to do that as well. And step in and help out. If there's a player at the table who's not focusing, who's not doing who's, there's a few things that you sometimes get, and it's because people don't always read the room correctly. So you'll sometimes get players who talk over the players or who try and take other people's turns for them, things like that. And just, you know, you need to, I was going to say, not call them out on it, but you need to sort of address that. And it's often easier for a player to say like, oh, sorry, just let them choose what they're doing first, if you see what I mean, and just step in gently. With that, and obviously, if it escalates, then take a break. And
that's a different conversation.
Be prepared to say, do you need to stay in here or not? I think we need to be, safety tools help mitigate that, as that's your sort of way out. I've run loads and loads of Cruncher games, and literally the worst I've had is people being a little bit disengaged because they maybe had too much to drink either before the game, during the game, or the night before. Or people just like going off and not coming back for a bit. You know, it's dealable with. If you think about the horror stories that, you know, convention GMs will sit around and tell you, that tends to be what it is. It's vanishingly few people that will actually show up and deliberately do it, because even the people who are doing that they've showed up to have a good time. Like they just misread what the expectation is.
Everybody's literally signed up for this, right?
So,
I think the last little piece that I'll throw in there, echoing a lot of what you just said, in this ties to the safety tools, but, you know, setting the expectations at the beginning, and being very like, this is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to do it. Let's go. And then you have a reference point if you ever need to call back to you. Like, remember when we talked about this? This is kind of like what we were going to do. We're not going to kind of do this. That makes a ton of sense. So, Guy, the last thing I always like to do with all my guests is I'd like to find out what you've been digging lately. So I want to find out what you've been grooving on. Is there any RPGs out there that you've just come across? Any video games, books, movies, prestige TV, anything recently that has just gotten its hooks into you and not let go?
I think the game that I'm most into at the moment is probably Fabula Ultima.
Oh, tell me about it.
So it's Need Games. I think it was originally published in Italian. It's now been translated into English, and they bring out supplements for it. So it's a JRPG. So it's sort of Final Fantasy style. And it has a really simple system that also has quite a bit of tactical depth. So monsters have, there's different damage types that they're vulnerable or resistant to. And lots of the character types have ways that they can manipulate what damage they do. So in a fight, there's this extra thing about kind of like, they're ice demons. Let's see, someone must have a fire attack we can use against them. Really neat setting. So the setting stuff they've brought out is sort of broad brush strokes. This is the ancient forest. Here are some things that could happen in it. Nothing set in stone. Here are some hooks. And some really nice things going on. And that thing about tabletop RPGs that emulate the Final Fantasy thing that's massive in video games, like they're quite rare, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, there are a ton in Japan published in Japanese that are gradually being translated, but it's a really nice sort of play experience. It also comes with the absolute best in class quick start I've ever seen.
How so? What makes it so good?
So the quick start, the four pre-gens have got their character sheets, and the sections on it are numbered. And they're numbered according to the scenes that you play through in the quick start. So you start with scene one, you're doing this, right? So look in your character sheets, box one, you've got your stats. You're going to do a stat check now. They go through, it's like, right, okay, box two is fabulous points. This now triggers, you do it, and it unlocks it sequentially. It's a really, like, even if you're not going to run it, it's well worth, as an artifact for teaching a game, if you're going to run a one shot of a new system, it's really, really worth checking out. Because I think quick starts can be variable.
Yes.
And this is one where, I mean, the adventure is literally on rails, scene, but the way that it unlocks the character sheet is really, really clever. Really, really well done. That's the RPG that I'm thinking about the most and thinking about getting. So I've run a few things. I've got some stuff on the blog about it, but yeah, that's in rotation to come up on Conventional Gems as well, I think. In terms of video games, literally last night, I'm not a huge video game player. I'm not, you know, I don't spend too long in it. I'm not very good at spending hours and hours sat down doing it because, like, I've already got a hobby that takes hours of my time. But Assassin's Creed is something that I'll play every game that comes out to death. And so I literally, there was a little Black Friday sale last night. So I'll get Mirage. So I'm just starting wandering around the streets of Baghdad and doing it. I do find Assassin's Creed as well is really good for, it's actually really good for sort of RPG plot inspiration, because a lot of the missions are often quite short and quite self-contained and quite standard. So it's quite a good way of, there's a few one-shots that I've run where it's been like one little mission in Assassin's Creed that I've just adapted and thought, oh, it could be like this instead. So yeah, Assassin's Creed. I don't know. I'm not a huge TV. Again, I don't really binge TV or anything.
Yeah.
I watch it in the background. Not massively game related, but the current thing that I'm watching most of is, I don't know if any of your listeners at UFC nailed it. It's a baking show.
So my wife and my 9-year-old daughter are together and we're like, what do you want to watch? You know, because we have all like different things and stuff.
Yeah.
That's the one show we can put on that all three of us will be entertained.
It's just brilliant. So it's a baking show. They've got to make sort of prestige decorated cakes. All three contestants are terrible at it.
Yep.
And so made these terrible cakes, and it's sort of explaining it to listeners that probably know what it is. I discovered this week that it may be different in different regions. In Netflix UK, you can get Nailed It Germany.
Oh no.
As well. So the German show as well, uh-huh, with obviously all the celebrities, German comedians you've never heard of. It's all in German subtitled, but it just, that extra tweak to it just makes it even more hilarious.
That
the jokes are slightly off and you don't quite get what's going on. And they're making cakes for some reference that you don't put. It just makes it just that slight bit, you know, extra. The icing on the cake, if you will.
Yeah, right. What's interesting about that show to me is if you describe that show to me, I would be put off immediately, right? Yeah. Which is, we're going to get people that are bad at something. They're going to do it. And we're going to make fun of the fact that they're bad at it. That sounds like a terrible show to me. What's really unique about Nailed It is how positive the show is. And that, I think that's the big surprise, is you end up falling in love with these contestants and you end up rooting for them and you celebrate their little successes. It's not about going, you're bad at this. It's about, you know what? You did pretty damn good for somebody who doesn't do this for a living. That's the big surprise for me.
Yeah. And everyone's equally, I think the level of expertise is equal as well, isn't it? Everyone's the premise of the show is that everyone's going to compete. They're going to make it okay. They're given really advanced, really difficult things to do. Yes. They don't do it. They make this complete mess. Everyone laughs. It's hilarious. We were into it. It's like to give it a RPG equivalent. It's like running a game of Trophy or like Hardcore Cthulhu, where you're like, right, at the end of this, you're all going to be dead.
You're dead.
But and as long as you all accept that at the start, it's great fun.
Yep. 10 candles is the same way, right? So here's the deal.
Completely.
You guys are all going to be dead at the end of this. So let's play.
I mean, I'm not sure how that, you know, that licensing crossover is going to work between Nailed It and 10 Candles, but I'm sure that Free League or Modifius are on the phone now trying to negotiate that as we speak, so as I listen to this.
Oh God. So Guy, there is a lot of really cool things to do on a Saturday afternoon that don't involve talking to me. So I really appreciate you making the time.
It's been a pleasure. It's been great to get on finally. We've had to reschedule a few times, haven't we, over the last year or something. But no, it's been really, really good.
Oh boy, yeah. You guys, the behind the scenes on this, guys. You'd think we were trying to plan an RPG session the way it took forever to find it.
And I'll tell you what, Craig, as well, obviously we're starting up on Conventional Gems. It's 2-hour one shots. come along. If we can schedule it, come along and play, come along and run. We'll get you on and we'll hook up like that as well. That'd be really good.
Done deal. So let's just say that that's going to happen and let's make it happen because I love playing on other channels and I love participating in it.
Yeah.
And one of the thoughts that I had is we need to talk about you coming out of my channel and running a one shot too. So maybe make that a goal for us here in 24 coming up.
Yeah. Let's collab. That's what they say. That sounds great. So people younger than us say, isn't it?
So everybody listening, you know the routine. Everything we've talked about is linked. Just scroll down in the show notes. You can go to Guy's blog. We can go to his YouTube channel. We can see all of this in action, as well as the stuff that we talked about, the games that he mentioned. Last but not least, this is the end. And you listened to the whole thing, and I appreciate you doing it. Take care.
Thanks a ton for tuning into another fantastic episode of Tabletop Talk. A big shout out to Guy for joining me today. You can find out more about his work on burnafterrunningrpg.com. Do you enjoy playing or running one-shot sessions? I'm dying to hear your thoughts. Let me know on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Blue Sky, or maybe even drop me a line at admin@thirdfloorwars.com. Don't worry, all those links are in the show notes waiting for you. Could you do me a solid and hit that subscribe button or leave me a rating? I bet one of your pals would love this episode, so why don't you share it with them? You do not want to miss the next episode. I talk with James D'Amato about his book and actual play podcasts. Happy gaming, friend. Hey, you know that thing you've been thinking about? That idea that's been kind of bouncing back and forth in your brain space? Why don't you pull out a sheet of paper, a pad of paper, and start working on it? Because damn it, today's a good day to make.
My friend, you're a pro. Great segment.
Doing very good. Yeah, just get chatting.
I've got a break listed on the call sheet between running a one shot and convention play. I'm suspecting that they're going to bleed together into one segment.
Yeah.
And if they do, that's great. If they don't, we'll just play it by ear. So don't be surprised if I start bleeding into the other.
Yeah, it's fine. I'll just let you lead.
All right, I'll bring this back. Are you still here? Wow. Well, the episode is over, but if you're bored, why not go to patreon.com and support the show for as little as $1 a month? Yeah, you can just scroll down and get the link. It's Patreon that makes this and all of our other content possible. Don't you want to join the other floorheads on the Patreon Discord? Anyway, thanks for sticking around. Take care. Bye.